So we are at Peabody College on the campus of Vanderbilt University with the Dean of Education and Human Development, Camilla Bembo. She's also a professor here and has a whole slew of other wonderful career qualifications and honors and so on. But let's talk about your job as dean and what you're still working on in terms of the research. And let me start by saying that we met and talked most recently at this Education Prize Advisory Meeting that was at the Salk Institute. And we asked us a series of questions about is there some sort of potential in an incentive-driven approach to innovation in education? We were talking about the possibility of some sort of a prize, and how would you go about even conceiving of it? What would be the constraints, the opportunities, what are the metrics, and so on? And we asked a number of questions, including what would constitute an ideal education that prepared children for a future, what metrics could be used to determine how well and the children and the schools were doing, and how should you structure a competition. But let's get into that piece by piece. Let's first of all talk about Peabody College, Vanderbilt University. This is one of the people around the table at this meeting said, when he knew who you were, oh, that's the best school in the United States for this sort of thing. So tell me a little bit about Peabody College. And
thank you. We're actually one of the oldest institutions in this country. We were founded in 1885, just 5 years after the founding of Nashville. And so we're actually older than Vanderbilt University, which is ironic in a way. But we were an independent institution, went through lots of different transformations. George Peabody left, who was the very first philanthropist. He actually developed housing for the poor in London, mm-hmm. and there is a statue of him there. And when he died, he gave all his money away, and you'll see lots of different places that have the name Peabody in front of them.
And the Peabody Trust in England, as you say, Peabody Dwellings. You're right.
Yeah. And we first got a gift from the Peabody Trust and developed at the Peabody Normal School. But he decided after a certain number of years that they wanted to spend the whole corpus and give it to one project. And that was Peabody College. He decided to take all the money, that was what he had left the instructions to do, to found Peabody College. And so in 1914, this campus opened up as Peabody College with his gift. And it's a college of education and human development. We have always had both sides to this college because we feel that development and learning go hand in hand. Learning pushes development, but development also pushes learning. So it's very synergistic to have both on the same campus. And we were an independent institution until 1979 when we merged with Vanderbilt University, which has been a wonderful coalition, wonderful partnership. As we kind of joke, it might have been a shotgun wedding because it happened rather quickly, but it nonetheless was a great wedding. And it has withstood the test of time.
So let's just begin with scouting around this first question that we had at the meeting a couple of weeks ago. What would constitute an ideal education to prepare children? And you have a very well-known paper that you did with Julian Stanley, one of the legends of the field, called Inequity in Equity. How equity in quotes can lead to inequity for high potential students. So there's some thoughts in here about the way we should construct a system that would encourage and promote learning. Do you want to sort of scout that for me?
Well, I think many times we look at educational programs and we try to make them fit everybody and fit their needs, and we try to treat people the same. But my basic argument is there's nothing more inequitable than to try to treat everyone exactly the same, because everyone is an individual. Everyone has different needs and interests and passions, and that what an educational system needs to do is to build on the talents of the children, their interests and passions, and to help them move along, move forward, and bring out the best in them. And that's not necessarily by giving everybody the same thing. There is no such thing as one size fits all. And that's what we have as an educational system. It was started off, in the early part of the 20th century. We kind of picked up a manufacturing model. where we moved kids through at a certain pace with the same procedures regardless. And so kids have to change to fit the curriculum. It isn't that the curriculum is adjusted to fit the needs of the kids. And so I've always said, when you look at other areas beyond academics, if you look at, for example, if you're going to buy shoes for your children, you don't buy age 7 shoes. You go and have them fitted and you buy the shoe that fits. If you're going to go piano lessons, the piano teacher will say, well, let me see what you can do. And that's where you pick up and that's where you go from. When you have tennis lessons or skiing lessons or whatever, again, they find out what can you do and we go from there. Mm-hmm. In academics, in reading, in math, science, whatever, we don't look at what the capabilities of the students are, where they're at, and build from that. Instead, we give them one curriculum, and the student is supposed to fit into that curriculum. I don't think that's effective. So when you talk about what is an ideal curriculum, I think it's an ideal curriculum, an ideal learning environment, is one that is tailored to the individual children in the classroom, that builds on the knowledge that they have, that uses their cultures to help and facilitate learning, that takes their passions and talents and allows and uses that to stimulate further growth, even in areas that they're maybe not so interested in. But it's to individualize and know the individual students and to tailor the educational experiences to allow for maximal growth.
Now, you probably wouldn't get a single parent disagreeing with you on that.
Probably
not.
Because
that sounds wonderful, ideal. You would probably get teachers saying to you, it's hard enough trying to cope as it is. What is she talking about, looking after the individual needs of a child? How on earth do you possibly do that?
Yes. And we have to acknowledge that this is very expensive, and it is hard to do. But you asked me what is ideal. And so I'm going to tell you what I think is ideal. I actually think that this age and grade lockstep doesn't serve us well. That I think it would be much better for us to have longitudinal teaching teams in, say, for example, mathematics, in science, reading, social studies, what have you, where this child is, you know, moves along the curriculum in each area on at their own pace. And it's a different way of organizing instruction. I think the other part is that, you know what, we shouldn't place kids in first grade just because they happen to be 6 years old. Why did we ever start that practice? Well, because on average, a 6-year-old is ready to learn reading, but some are ready to learn reading at 4, and some at 7 or 8. So it's just a very proximal variable. It might be just much better to actually see what they can do and go from there. So yes, it is expensive, but you know what? You don't go to the doctor and as a class. The doctor spends individual time with you to tailor with what your needs are. But I think that, what most people would say, is an ideal time.
And two things that came up at the meeting, I remember two phrases. One was exactly what you said. It was one size fits none.
Right.
And the second thing was in terms of looking at the children as individual learners, that there might be some way in which you could use technology to assist with that. Certainly the use of computers and so on, which are probably poorly used by all accounts. The use of a teacher to give appropriate mentoring and instruction, but to allow lots of time for individual study using a computer interface, that seems to be one of the things that people favored.
I think technology is a wonderful tool and a wonderful resource. I don't think it can replace the teacher, but I think it's something to supplement it, and I think it can make us more powerful. So I'm very supportive of that. But it's still why, you know, when you think about it, who's the best teacher? It's generally the best teacher is the parent. And why is the parent the best teacher? Because they know the child. And they can draw on the child's knowledge and experiences to move to the next level. And so you'd have to have technology that can really be tailored to help. But I think it's a great idea to be able to use them as supplements to the instruction. So if you are falling behind in reading, you know, to have a tailored program. But sometimes those kids who are struggling need even more people attention rather than less. It tends to be, you know, kids who are more advanced are more capable of working on their own, while those who are struggling, they need more of that human element to help them move forward. But that doesn't mean that you can't use the technology as a learning support.
Yeah, the one difficulty we all face as we sat around that table was to say, suppose you had something like an X Prize. Right. Well, fine. What the X Prize did was the original one, you put something into orbit, land it, put it into orbit and land it again. And when one talked to Peter Diamandis, the CEO of the XPRIZE Foundation, about this, whether they had an education XPRIZE, he said, well, we've thought about it, but it's just a huge systemic problem. It's not a confined, a simple task like that. So that becomes very similar, in a sense, to the health prize that they've been working on at the moment. How do you deal with these enormous systemic issues? And I mentioned, as you'll recall at the meeting, the three major stories that have come out most recently about the education issue. There's a cover of Newsweek, the key to saving American education says, we must fire bad teachers. And the cover of the New York Times was building a better teacher. And the Atlantic magazine, this Amanda Ripley story, which is lovely, was what makes a great teacher. So the emphasis was on teachers. And one wonders, that's obviously important, but here's the other paper that we use, a paper from Science by members of the Temple Dynamics of Learning Center, including Terry Sanofsky and Javier Mavean, and that's titled Foundations for a New Science of Learning. So we raise the question of, sure, it's good to build better teachers, but how about building better learners? What can we do? What do we know about creating the kind of environment and using science to explore better techniques for creating better learners? Mm-hmm. And this is kind of your area. I know you do psychometrics to a great extent, but there's the whole general background as well. Could you speak to that?
Well, I think teaching and learning are synergistic. You can't really separate them out. And that's why actually our department here is called Teaching and Learning. That's the department that trains teachers in our college. It's a teaching and learning department. And when you think about the learning environment, it's consisted of the learner and the teacher. And if you have a strong teacher, that helps the learner become even better. So you can't really separate them out. And let me just first address the teacher issue, and then I'll move on to the learner issue. Okay. It's understandable why people focus on the teachers, because all the studies have shown that's the most critical element in terms of learning. That if you are exposed to three great teachers in 3 years in a row, you can make tremendous gains. And if you have exposed to three very poor teachers, you really fall behind, and it's going to be very hard to catch you up. So the teacher is a very critical element in terms of creating a better learner. So, of course, everybody has been looking out to see, well, what makes an effective teacher? And we honestly don't know. You know, we all have ideas, we all have studies, but we really, at this point, can't identify what are the characteristics of an effective teacher. It's obviously and clearly a very important research program that we need to pursue. And that's going to influence the learner. I think that, you know, down the road, I think that in terms of how do we build a better learner, that does perhaps get into more of a neuroscience, developmental psychology, cognitive psychology, that kind of interface to basically have a better sense of the learning process. If you can tie it back to the neuroscience and this, you know, to the brain and changes in the brain, so much the better. I mean, but we're not there yet that we can do that, but that might help. But I think there are things that we are learning about in development. We learn that very young children, for example, despite what we think, that this is very young children, they don't learn from videos by just putting a video in front of them. We would have thought that if you put an Einstein video, for example, right in front of them, that teaches some wonderful concepts, that the kids would just somehow take it in. doesn't work. There has to be a facilitator, a human person there that seems to point out what's important. Now, when they're older, they can do that, but not a young child. So we're learning about the capabilities of the children early on, and in terms of what works and what, you know, what is a good learner. So I think that in terms of building a better learner, we need to understand their cognitive structures. What are their, for example, what are their strengths? If you know that a child seems to, you know, there are really three symbol systems that kids, you know, that have come out in terms of abilities. You can manipulate numerical symbols, verbal symbols, or then there are the, you know, the visual, symbolic type of symbols. And some people are just good at manipulating images really well. And that's what I meant by symbolic, or actually the images. If you understand where the greatest strengths are, if you're good with working with images, for example, and rotating things in space and working with your hands, then can we tailor the instruction to build on that strength, but also shore up the other abilities to make them stronger? Or if you tend to be more mathematical, how do we draw on those abilities and those strengths to help in other areas? I think we need to know the child, the individual child, and their capacities better so that the teacher can work with them better. But definitely building a better learner, I think, comes down to understanding their development and their capacities and capabilities and what they can do at certain ages and moving them forward. And we have been underestimating children's capabilities for many, many years. They're capable of doing many more things at earlier ages than we thought.
Could you just explore a little bit that notion, that phrase you used about longitudinal learning and...
Well, to me, what would be important is the structure...
Rather than the lockstep.
Yes, the lockstep. Well, what order should we be teaching concepts? Is there a sequence that we should be, for example, teaching mathematics in that is optimal? Right now, we don't really know. We're guessing and we have a feel that these things perhaps should be taught in this order, but we really don't have the research at what time should we introduce these concepts. And if we introduce these concepts at that age, can we then introduce these other concepts a little later and it'll be easier for them to learn those concepts? So what we really need to do is to look at kids learning across years. See, right now we just tend to look at learning at one point in time, maybe within a grade, but how does the things that we teach them in first grade relate to what they are capable of doing, for example, in fifth grade? Is there an optimal way of introducing and building on these concepts that makes those children grasp those concepts better? So I'm thinking the best way is, how do you build? How do you prepare kids for algebra? Then once you're in algebra, how do you move for algebra, geometry, trigonometry, and calculus? But that's what you need to be thinking about, is what are the end products, the end skills, capabilities, and knowledge that these kids need to have? And can we reverse engineer backwards and figure out what is the optimal way of making sure that the kids master those things?
Yeah, it's actually kind of exciting to me in the sense that in talking to these different constituencies on this campus, but they do talk to each other, so that a couple of days ago I was talking to lawyers, and they were talking about the use of science, neuroscience, and biosciences in informing decisions, not only informing jurors and how they make their decisions or finding out how jurors make their decisions, but in finding out how judges make their decisions and informing them in how to make better decisions, right, and so on. And then you walk across to the psychology department, to Wilson Hall, and there are people working on perceptual expertise. And it's not just, as you know, verbal fluency. There's this notion of perceptual fluency. Are you able to discern different categories and shapes and so on and so forth? And I can't but think that this stuff will eventually find its way into a classroom and will produce leaps and bounds improvements, I think.
I think so. I think we have researchers here on campus who do interventions and then do an fMRI, scan the brain to see what the impact is of that intervention in terms of organization of the brain. I think down the road those things will inform instruction. We're not there yet. We got to be careful that we don't it doesn't become pop psychology if we don't start applying it before it's ready. Just like a lot of people, 20 years ago, started talking about right brain versus left brain as this was a left brain thing, that's a right brain thing, as if their left brain was asleep while this right brain was processing. We know that the two sides of the brain work together. They have maybe different strengths that they can do. And we also know how they can reorganize and, you know, how plastic the brain is. But people jumped on that too early, and it became a fad, and it didn't help education. So having seen so many fads enter into education, I get a little nervous when we start talking about these things, and people start taking them and saying, we're going to apply this to the classroom right now. I think what we need to say, yes, this is a very powerful technology. These are very powerful research investigations that could reveal many interesting things about the brain. It could perhaps help us diagnose learning disabilities early, pick up who's likely to become autistic at an early age before we're really aware of it. And so we can intervene early, because the sooner you intervene, the usually the more effective you can be. But we're not quite there yet. So, you know, and I would hate for that whole thrust of science to become ignored because we jumped on it too early.
Right. On the other hand, you would doubtless empathize with a patient, with a parent who's thinking, you know, I can't wait. I mean, I don't want this to be a lost generation of kids here.
But that's how we had facilitated communication, and that turned out to not work. Yeah. And so, you know, we have, in terms of educating children, and especially when you talk about educating kids with developmental disabilities, you have a very small window or time to intervene to make a difference. And you want to make sure how you use that time, you use it well. And that's especially true with kids with developmental disabilities, because they're less able to adjust. Mm. You know, a gift to kid, which is who I work with, you can mess up pretty much. They recover, and they help you figure out what you were supposed to do and move on. But a kid at the other end, you have to structure that learning experience very carefully so that you can keep them on track.
So tell me about the work with gifted children and so on, and how you got into that and why and what you're finding out about.
Well, I was going to be a clinical psychologist. That was my intent when I went to college, until I took a class by Julian Stanley. And he started talking about these mathematically gifted kids. And I thought it was just fascinating. So in the middle of my senior year, I went and talked to him, and I said, you know, I think your work is really interesting. I think I'd like to do graduate study in this area. And this was right before the holiday break. And so he said, well, all right, Camilla, I'm going to give you all these books here to read. And you come back in a month. And if you read them and you still are interested, let's talk. So, you know, it was break. I read everything he gave me and was really hooked. And this is it. So I came back even more interested, even more motivated. And so I started doing, you know, work with Julian Stanley on this area of giftedness. And that's how I got into it. When I got involved and I participated, I started participating in the project in December of 1976 when we did a talent search for gifted kids. But when I got involved, we were at a time when we were experimenting with what are the best ways to identify math-talented kids, and math and scientifically talented kids. We found out pretty early on that you didn't have to measure science separately, but if you measured math, you kind of got those kids who were good at science, too. So we focused on math, and then, you know, can't just identify kids and say you're math-talented, congratulations, go on. We felt it was very important that we then help them develop their talents. So we helped them understand what their talents were. And then we experimented. What are the best ways to develop their talents? How do we intervene? What kind of learning experiences do they require? And so we kind of experimented with fast-paced math classes, fast-paced science classes, teaching algebra in a day. We gave up on that one. But anyway, we experimented, and I think, you know, by 1980, we felt, you know what? We figured out a good way to identify them. We figured out a way to service them outside of schools as a complement to our schools. So it's not a replacement, but a complement to our schools. And we said, you know, we don't have to do this over and over again because we've been doing it. You know, they started a little bit before me. They've been doing it for a number of years. So we then developed these talent searches at Duke, Northwestern, and so on to carry on the work. What we decided to do at that point in time was that we moved out of the programmatic area and decided to focus on the longitudinal study. So what we wanted to do was to find out, well, what, you know, all right, we did all these interventions, and other people are continuing to do, and they experiment. They don't do exactly what we do. They put their own twists on it and make them better. But we follow them up through adult lives to understand, you know, taking a long term, like a, you know, 35-year perspective, what works best? So which of the interventions that we tried had the biggest impact later on in life when they're age 50, for example? So we looked at that. We also wanted to look at what is the development of excellence in math and science. So if you, you know, how does talent develop, not just as a child, as an adolescent, but as an adult? And what separates those people who become excellent STEM professionals versus those who become eminent? So, you know, now we've kind of moved into this domain. We've take those kids, we profile them at age 12. We at age 18 we follow them up, at age 23, mid 30s, and now at mid at 50.
And this still holds true that the it was the math ability as a bedrock that predicted that there was a better way of testing, and that the science came along with the math. Is that what you're saying?
We know that science didn't
The reason I ask you that is I hear many undergraduates and graduate students who are in sciences of some kind who nevertheless protest that they're not very good at math. So it's sort of, maybe they're being modest, I don't know.
There's a funny thing in our country, and I'm going to get back to this issue, but there's a funny thing in this country that gets me very upset. It is socially acceptable to say you're no good at math. It's socially acceptable to say I can't balance my checkbook. It's not socially acceptable to say I can hardly read.
Yeah.
Why is it acceptable to say you're no good at math? And I think that is something we have to attack as a nation, because if anything, in our highly technological society that we're working in today, math and science are even more important than ever. But I sometimes think that people downplay their mathematical skills. Sometimes people think of mathematics as just plain computation, and they may be lousy at that because they're sloppy. Mm-hmm. But they're good at math reasoning. They can reason their way to their solution, but then they make a mistake, a careless error sometime, but they see the solution. They're very good at reasoning. But to go back to what you were talking about, we actually think now, having done even more research, we didn't know that in the 70s. We found out in the 70s that when we measured math and we measured science, that the science test that we offered didn't give us any additional information that we didn't get from the math test. So therefore, it was not of any help to us to give the science test, and we could just save it. But what we have found since that time, if we're going to really be good at guiding these children and helping them find career paths that are good for them, the things that they might want to try, we also need to measure another ability, and that's spatial ability. And so, depending upon what science you want to go into, spatial ability is very important. So if you're going to become an engineer, you need to be not only good at math, but you probably need some pretty good spatial skills. Depending upon, you know, where, what kind of biology you're doing, maybe the spatial ability isn't as critical, but you still, chemistry, you got to be able to image and so on. So we think that in terms of identifying scientifically talented individuals, you need math and you need spatial. And you need to know their passions, of course. Mm-hmm. So we can't, using math and spatial, we can sort of say, oh, this looks like they're heading towards an engineering or a physics kind of path. But it's their passions and interests that will determine exactly where they will end. It's just like you can't, when you take about a chemical solution, you can say, well, hey, you put these chemicals in, these things are going to come together and bond, but you can't tell me which molecule is going to go with exactly which other molecule. You just know that these two types will come together. That's the same thing with human people. We can't talk about individuals that exactly, but we can say as groups, they will head in that kind of a direction. So that's how we have moved, and that's very predictive. We can predict very well from their math and spatial ability in science. Verbal is also important. Don't get me wrong, but if the verbal, the math, and the spatial are extremely important. Whereas those who are really good at verbal, but you know. Okay, in math and space, they tend to go on to the humanities and those type of things. You tend to do what you're good at.
Mm. This is the study of mathematically precocious youth after 35 years paper, and there's some mention in here about sex differences as well. Let me just mention that a couple of the things that I talked about earlier. First of all, there was this report came out while we were sitting around another conference table called Why So Few from the American Association of University Women. It was funded by NSF, and it was about women in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and saying that despite the numbers going up, the number of people, women having tenure or being in distinguished positions and so on, such as yours, still wasn't going up that very fast, especially in science and technology, STEM areas. And then there's a piece that Nick Kristof wrote in the New York Times, March 27th. And the headline is, "The Boys Have Fallen Behind." Around the globe, it's mostly girls who lack educational opportunities. Even in the United States, many people still associate the educational gender gap with girls left behind in math. Yet these days, the opposite problem has sneaked up on us. In the United States, and other Western countries alike, is mostly boys who are faltering in schools. It shows that girls, on average, have achieved some, on average, which is a point you're going to make, I know, have achieved parity with boys in math, and they're ahead in verbal skills. So to somebody just being bombarded by the stories as they come, it's kind of, what how do I make sense of all of this? And you've been in the midst of these trenches for a long time. What's your sense of all of this?
Yeah, this is an area that I kind of fell into that I sometimes wonder why in the world I got into it. But anyway, I was just an eager graduate student, and I just couldn't believe that there were sex differences. And I was going to go through the data, and I was quite sure that I was going to be able to show that this was absolutely wrong in the data that we had. So I started off.
But why did you think? Why could you not believe that there were?
I just didn't believe it as a female, and I was good at math too. That I just didn't think that was true. But you know, it was rather overwhelming at the time. But things have gotten better. Things have gotten better since the late 70s. A lot better for women. And what I would say is, you have to be careful with what kinds of abilities you measure. And this is something sometimes neuroscientists don't spend as much time thinking about their actual tasks, and they don't understand that there are many mathematical abilities, many verbal abilities, and they're not the same. And that you got to be very careful about the task that you pick. In math, there are kind of three domains. You have computation, ability to apply learned concepts, and then you have math reasoning. Girls have always been better at computation than boys. And even at the time when I published my controversial sex differences papers, the ability to apply learned concepts, girls were just as good as boys. There was no difference. We only found a difference in math reasoning ability. What you're seeing today in the tests is girls get better grades in math classes all through college. They now take as many math classes as the boys. But we still have sex differences at the very high end in math reasoning ability. They're not as large as they used to be. which is a good thing. So they have diminished, and I can only applaud that, but they are still there. And so when you look at average differences, you also have to look at distributions. And the distribution of math scores for very talented boys and talented girls differ. And when we look at the distributions of math scores and the verbal scores, let's take a math and verbal. If you look at the verbal scores, they're just a bell-shaped curve. For girls, for boys, you can just put them right on top of each other, and there is just no difference. You put the girls' math scores right on top of the verbal scores, and it's a bell-shaped curve. It might be up and down a little bit on the distribution, but it's the same distribution. You put the boys' scores on there, and the scores are skewed. That is, there are more boys at the top than what you would expect. That's the question you have to ask. And they're still there. Not in the same proportions as before, but they're still there. So lots of progress has been made. Girls are certainly going to college in higher rates than boys. So yes, in some ways, boys are being left behind. But when you look at the highest level of achievement, even if you look at the younger generation, not the generation like me, where there were some bias and sexism and barriers in place, compared to now, where there are much fewer, than not compared to what it was 30 years ago, for example, you still are seeing some differences there. So there's a long way to go there. You know, so you see many more engineers who are, for example, males, physicists. And the numbers, the disparities get bigger as you get to the higher levels. So, you know, so it depends on what you're looking at, what part of the distribution you're looking at, what kinds of abilities you're looking at. Are you looking at classwork, or are you looking at things that go on in careers and so on? So it's a much more complex picture.
And those curves over, say, another 25-year period could easily shift. I mean,
they could shift, I guess.
Unless one is claiming some absolutely unchangeable innate difference in the neurocognitive architecture, which makes certain groups of boys better mathematicians than females.
We know that the brain is plastic. We know that it comes out with many potentialities. I think that at this point in time, to say that there is something irreversible, that it would be, wouldn't be scientifically supported.
It is certainly, however, a point of interest. I mean, there's a new book out. There's a couple of new books that I was looking at only last week, one by Luanne Brizendine called The Male Brain. She did The Female Brain before. And Lise Elliott has one called Pink Brain, Blue Brain, I think. Again, looking at male-female differences. So I think it's fairly inevitable that people are going to continue to be interested in all this sort of stuff.
We have to acknowledge that there are sex differences in the brain. I think we've known that for a long time. I actually went to a conference on that in 1983, so that was a long time ago. Now, again, most of it is animal work at that time, but still, there are some sex differences in the brain. So I think the question, yes. So the question is, well, it's still an interesting question. We're still awfully similar. Yeah. There's more similarities than there are differences.
So let's just cycle back for a second there, because you said you were in college intending to become a clinical psychologist. But go back, I mean, why would you even know that such a thing as a clinical psychologist existed? I mean, most people say they want to be an artist or a business person. Yeah, or something.
Well, I remember I think I've always was curious why people do the strange things that they do. I was always interested in human behavior and observing people, and always sometimes amazed at the things people do. So I was always interested in studying and understanding behavior. That led me to psychology, and psychology led me first to clinical psychology, because I saw it this way as understanding behavior in the helping profession. And it wasn't until I saw this part of psychology that I realized that this attracted me more.
Right. Yeah. Did you have parents with a science background or in
my
medical?
My father was a physicist.
Okay, so that's just a little hint there.
Yeah.
So did he encourage you? I mean, he talked science to you when you were growing up?
Oh, yeah. I think I was my daddy's girl, yeah. So we had a very close relationship, yeah, together. So.
Yeah. So you went then from into this. This is fairly quickly straight into this. I mean, this has been meeting Julian Stanley is a seminal point at this point, isn't it? Then.
Yes, it was. Yes, yes. I mean, it was a life-changing. Yeah. Situation. And it was a course on psychological testing, but he talked so much about mathematically gifted kids that that's how I heard, and I thought it was just fascinating what they could do. I mean, that you could teach them, you know, you could teach them math. I mean, at the time, you could teach them 2 years of math in 1 year. I thought, wow, well, now we can do it in 3 weeks, you know, but, you know, it was just amazing to me what their capabilities and that kids at age 12 could, you know, blow off the top of the SAT test that is designed for 12th graders. How could a 12-year-old take the SAT and get a top score possible?
Now, were these were kids not, I mean, was there some socioeconomic distinction in these kids? Were they all from good homes or something? Or were they
not all of them. I mean, clearly more of them come from, you know, from that, but yeah. We had lots of kids who come from lower SES backgrounds whom we helped, and that's one of the things that I always point out is that many people feel that programs for gifted kids are elitist. Why should you give special consideration to kids who already have so much? And first of all, I think everybody should be given the opportunity to learn something new every day. Yeah. That everybody should be given the opportunity to reach their potential, whatever it is. Right. And so I think equality is giving access to appropriate educational opportunities for yourself, whatever those whatever is appropriate for you. But I think that, let me see, I think I lost my train of thought. So we were talking about, what, go back now.
Well, no, it was the question of what do you, all right, so yeah. let me, I know where you're going with this, but where we were going with this, which is, what do you do, suppose you have a population of mathematically challenged youth.
Oh, I know what it is, I know. Well, I know what I was going with, the poor kids. This is where I kind of talk about, is that, I think everybody needs to be given access to an appropriate and challenging right. education. When we take away gifted programs, who are the kids that we hurt most? Think about it just a little bit. If you have educated parents who have resources, you take away the gifted program in the schools, what will those parents do? They will find some supplementary program. They will figure out what they can do to help their child, to keep their child stimulated. But if you're coming from a background where you're poor or you're not highly educated, you really don't know what you need to do for the child, then you don't have the resources to pay for a tutor or for a special summer program. You may not even know what's appropriate to do. And so when you take away the programs for gifted children, the kids you hurt the most are the poor kids. And aren't those the kids that in some ways you'd like to make sure that they have the opportunities? Mm-hmm. And what we find is that programs for gifted kids tend to impart much more than just knowledge and motivation and meeting with other kids, which is very stimulating to be with your peers. They also give you knowledge and set expectations that, well, you know, it's great that you're going to go to college, but, you know, you shouldn't be thinking of a community college. You should be going to a first-rate university. Or, you know, you shouldn't be thinking just of a college degree. You need to get a graduate degree. And, you know, do you know that you need to take the PSAT in 10th grade so that you can qualify for national merit? These are things that parents who are educated kind of know. But if you're coming in from another country, you don't know the system, mm-hmm. or you yourself didn't go to college, you don't have that knowledge, you may not be able to help your child as well as somebody who has been through that experience. And that's what gifted programs do. And that's why I think they're so important. In addition to challenging, you know, and providing good learning experiences so that they grow, and so that we can see that their potential is growing every year too, their achievement is growing. It's about a lot more than that.
Yeah, one of the questions that we talked about at this meeting, was about what metrics you'd use to determine how individual children and schools were achieving this ideal. And one of the things we went on to from that was to say, well, you know, are we talking about all ages of all children? I mean, are there some acupressure points here where we should be concentrating on and so on? And what surprised me, because I had no idea this was going to come out of the discussion, was that there was a sense that before kindergarten was a point at which you could put in some useful measures. And the other point that, obviously people talked about all age groups, but the other one that a number of people subscribed to is between 8th grade and 9th grade, because that appeared to be when a lot of people drop out. Have you rethought any more about that, or do you
think? I favored early childhood years. When kids come to school, the achievement gap is already there. Differences in achievement between more advantaged, privileged children versus kids who come from poor backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And those differences are there before they even begin school. So in essence, schools begin in kindergarten in a remediation mode. Why can't we try to see if we can't bring these kids up to have a more equal starting place? So I think that if you could start in early childhood years, one of the things we talked about is language and the number of words that kids are exposed to depending upon, you know, the parental backgrounds, you know. So some kids are just not exposed to a very rich language environment, so that limits their vocabulary growth. Also, we know that playing board games, for example, is a very good way of developing mathematical skills, numeracy. So these are things that you can do to develop that, so that kids learn their colors, learn their letters, but also develop a rich vocabulary, you know, some numeracy. Also, I think that, one of the things that we can look at is automaticity. That goes beyond that, but, you know, there are certain things that you just have to know and that you don't want to use cognitive resources for. So think about riding a bike. When you learn how to ride a bike, you had to concentrate awfully hard to stay on that bike and not fall off. And, you know, you couldn't talk at the same time that you were riding that bike. But after you've learned how to ride a bike, it's automatic. You don't think about it. You can talk. You can do all kinds of things while you're doing it. You need to do the same thing with, for example, mathematical, skills. So you need to know your math facts, for example, like that. So that when you're doing a problem, you're not spending your time thinking about what's 7 plus 5. Oh yeah, you just need to know that 7 plus 5 is 12, and you need to have those things fast because it frees up cognitive resources to apply to other problems. So this is, you know, I like to start early. We also know, you know, in sixth grade, I mean, not sixth grade, by first grade, six-year-olds, we can have a pretty good sense of who are the kids who are likely to drop out by ninth grade. Can we reverse that at that point in time? Can we put in interventions? But it's about that time, at the end of first grade, that kids develop an identity of themselves as, I'm not a learner, or I am a learner. And if they develop this identity of, I'm not a learner, this environment is not where I can succeed, they start to turn off. And then it becomes harder and harder to get them re-engaged. You can, and there are some people here, right, Rich Lehrer and Leona Schaubel, who can take kids who are in fifth grade, whom the teachers have given up on, and say, these kids cannot learn. They have gone into the schools and taken those kids and taught them mathematics. But what they have to do is they can't use the regular strategies that everybody uses. Mm-hmm. They have to go in through science and probability and geometry in order to capture those kids' attentions because they have already turned off. So they have to come in and do it again. It's an awful lot of hard work. Well, what about if we can do it right in the first place? That way, it's sort of like a stitch in time saves nine, mm-hmm. because by the time you get to ninth grade, what you have to do is heroic. And what you can do early on, it really pays off down the road. So is ninth grade a critical point? Yes, but it's a critical point because of everything that's happened up to ninth grade. And you're gonna have to reverse 8 years of schooling plus kindergarten. So really 9 years of schooling, you're gonna have to reverse. versus why not try from the start to get things right? So you can say, yes, but what about those kids who are struggling right now? Well, it's true. I mean, they're hard choices. But if I had to do one thing, I'd think I'd go back to early childhood, and I would do my best with these kids. But it takes a lot of time and effort.
Yeah, I had two thoughts on that. One is that intuitively that sounds right, but the reclamation project that could take place between 8th and 9th, which you say requires a heroic and major effort. Interestingly, you were saying there that science, so use of science at that point may well be a gripping way of getting people re-engaged, which sounds like a great idea at that point. So that's one good thing. The other thing is then in starting getting people to learn how to ride the bike. I remember that in my case, you also have to have a thing called a parent running behind you,
right.
holding the seat.
That's right.
Before they let you go. So the question is, who's holding the seat in those early years? And this is where you say
the teacher.
Teacher, but also the parent.
And the parent. The parent is the best teacher, they say. And that's probably true, I mean, to a certain extent, to a certain level. You know, at the early years when they know the child and they know the concepts and content that they can, you know, deal with. You get up to high school, the knowledge becomes so specific they may not be able to help their child. But that's the importance. I think you captured it there very well with the parent behind the bike, not letting go. And I think that's when we were talking about technology, when I kept saying, yes, it is a very powerful tool, but we still need the human element here. And that can't be lost. And until you are on your own, then you can do more. But at that beginning stage, that teacher, that mentor, whatever, is really incredible. So there will always be that human component. And that's why I said the technology, it's powerful, it's a wonderful supplement, it's great, but it'll never replace the teacher.
In this piece that I was looking at in the New York Times, I mentioned to you by Nick Kristoff, he cites a new book called Why Boys Fail by Richard Whitmire, with all this mountains of evidence about what's going on. But here is a statistic that just I found astounding. He says that one of the problems is an increased emphasis on verbal skills, often taught in sedate ways that bore boys. The world has become more verbal, boys haven't. The upshot, he writes, is that boys get frustrated, act out, and learn to dislike school. Quote, poor reading skills snowball through the grades. By the fifth grade, a child at the bottom of the class reads only about 60,000 words a year in and out of school, compared to a child in the middle of the class who reads about 800,000 words a year.
Well, you see how it's multiplicative.
And there is this famous, well-known term of art about a gap and words gap, and so on, which I forget for the moment. But the disparity between...
It's the Matthew effect. He who hath gets. It's accumulation of educational advantage. But I think this is what we've always talked about, too, with spatially gifted kids. There are kids, and we don't measure in our schools today spatial ability. We measure math, we measure verbal, but we don't measure spatial ability. And there are kids in there who are really fantastic in this domain, and they get lost. First of all, as he says, the curriculum in our schools is highly verbal. Somebody who is spatial gets turned off by that. And so you have to find those kids. Sometimes what you can see is how amazing their abilities are, because you can look at what are they doing outside of school. What kind of projects are they working on? Do they take apart the whole vacuum cleaner and put it right back together again? And things like that. Those kids learn by working with their hands, visualizing. Our curriculum is not designed for those kids. Those kids get turned off by the highly verbal curriculum, just like these boys. So I think that there is truth to that we have set up a curriculum that works better for girls. Now, if the boys can proceed and they succeed as they get into the college and they can make choices to get into engineering, they find these places that they can excel, and they take off. But I do think that we need to figure out different ways to capture their attention. And, you know, what you talked about, the differences in reading, it really is the multiplicative effect of taking advantage of educational opportunities. And you can just see how this snowballs down the road. And so we've always talked about, well, can we, you know, can they read about Edison? You know, can they read about Leonardo da Vinci? Can they read about robotics and inventions and things that capture their mind? They may not like Silas Marner, but they might like this. And who cares as long as they're reading?
Yeah, he says in there maybe there should be comic books and robot books. And
I think as long as they're reading, I don't care. Yes.
As long as they're doing it.
That's exactly right. And I don't think that our curriculum is set up for that. And that's, again, when I talk about, I'd really like to see, we have to realize that the learning environment, where there's a teacher and there are children, there are so many things that impact on that learning environment. The teacher's capabilities, the interests, motivation, the support that the teacher gets from the school, from the community, the growth. Do you have the capabilities of the kids, how they interact? Is this a managed learning environment where learning can occur? What are the expectations of parents as teachers? It's not just a teacher. You have to realize that the classroom is embedded in a social context. And that social context impacts what goes on in that classroom. So education is really, really complex. But you also have to tap on those interests of those children. And that's why I think we have to try to individualize learning as much as possible. And that's where technology can help you, diagnose, where you can get formative assessments, for example, who's making progress, who's not. Who's going to, don't wait till the end of the year where they take, say, the Iowa Test of Basic Skills or whatever achievement test is given in your school, and to say, whoops. Well, I guess in May, you know, oops, so-and-so fell behind, didn't make it. Why not do tests quick, little curriculum-based measurements that take only a few minutes throughout the school year so you can see who's making progress, who's not, how to change your instruction to make sure you bring people along. It's all part of individualizing the learning experience. And I think that's, you know, in terms of what I think of an ideal learning environment, it's one that is much more individualized than it is today. That doesn't mean that you don't work in groups, that you don't have projects, and you don't do all these things. But you also remember about the individual and their interests and passions. And
in the course of doing all the research and so on, did you actually find yourself having to go into classrooms and teach at points? And
I never taught. Right. No, I mean, I actually designed programs, and I worked with the kids, but I was not the teacher. I was not the teacher. So I know lots of the kids. They're not kids anymore, but sometimes, you know, I'll have to admit that I'm listening to NPR as I'm going home from work, and I hear a name, and I say, I think I remember him or her. Yeah. But they were only 12 at the time. And sure enough, I go back into the database, and yep, there they are. You know, so yeah, I worked with them, but I didn't do the teaching.
Yeah. If you hadn't done this, I'm just curious, if you hadn't done this, I'm thinking about choices now that people make, is there something else that you might have considered doing, not being a scientist? What else would you have loved to have done if you had a chance?
I think I grew up in an academic family, so I guess the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. So I think academia was always something that was interest to me. But I remember when I was an undergraduate, I was very interested in Jerry Levy's work and the split brain stuff.
Yeah, cool.
Because my dad was at Caltech, so I knew Roger Sperry, and I learned a lot about that. So I thought that was really fascinating. So I spent a lot of my early time, you know, studying that on my own. I thought that was just really, so I guess I probably would have become a neuroscientist if I hadn't gone in this direction, because that's really was the beginnings. So, you know, it was just kind of fascinating when they cut that corpus callosum and and what happened. So
of course, as you remember, the surgeon was Joseph Bogan, Joe Bogan, and Mike Gazzaniga was did a lot of that early work.
Yep, I remember. And, you know, so anyway, I got very much into that. I thought it was just a fascinating piece of work. And so I remember going to his lectures, Roger Sperry lectures, and the Marshmallow Building at Caltech.
Now, did you, as you'd been doing this work, you know, contrasting intellectual patterns, creativity, and so on, the kind of things that we do at the Temple Dynamics of Learning Center, the emphasis on the importance of timing at different time scales on learning, from literally, as we say, from synapse to schoolroom, and so on, is that a concept that had occurred to you, or is that do you see that as a, how do you?
You know what?
Did that come up in your work?
I actually, when I was at Iowa State University, I had a colleague, Michael O'Boyle, and he was a neuropsychologist, is what he, and and we had gotten into some stuff. Again, here's my interest in right brain, left brain type of stuff. You know, it all started with Norman Geschwin, and he, I think it was in the early 1980s, had come out with this paper that if you are exposed to high levels of prenatal testosterone, it has two impacts. It impacts the organization of the brain, making you more likely to have a strong right hemisphere, and therefore you're more likely to be left-handed. It also has had an impact on your thymus gland, and you're more likely to have allergies. So, you know, I read that, and I think it was just one of these news briefs in Science or something. It wasn't the article, I just read the news brief. Oh, gee, that's kind of interesting. You know, math, talent, you know, they think about that as something that, you know, right brain is heavily involved in. Mm. I thought, I wonder how many of my extremely math-talented kids are left-handed. Well, it just happened to be in the summer, and we were running our program. So I decided, I'm going to go out and take a walk and talk to the kids. First five kids were all left-handed, and I thought, oh, wow! I am really on to something here. Can I stop collecting data, you know? So, you know, I learned a lot about left-handedness and how you assess it, and then you needed to, you know, actually a scale. You can't just ask them. You have to use an Edinburgh, for example, headedness scale. And so we did a study of kids who were in the top 1 in 10,000 in ability, and we gave them a handedness inventory. I also worked with a person at Johns Hopkins Medical School about allergies and said, is there something about allergies? So we asked about allergies, and he said, well, we've always wondered if there was some adaptive benefit to allergies. And then somebody said, check out myopia. We, you know, there's this stuff going out there about myopia and that gifted kids tend to be more myopic. So we sent out the questionnaire to these kids, to their siblings, and to their parents, and to a typical average ability group. So we had lots of control. We had the within family, you know, controls. And these highly gifted kids were more than twice as likely to be left-handed, more than their families, more than twice as likely to have allergies and myopia. So I really got into this thing. And in 1986, you know, and I published it in Neuropsychologia at the time, and I was invited to a conference in Stockholm, the Venner Foundation. And so, you know, there was all these, again, neuropsychologists, neuroscientists.
Anthropologists as well, probably.
Yes, in this talking about it. And, you know, and I talked about, well, I wonder if there were, you know, and at that time, you know, it was 1986. They said, you know, I said, you know, maybe these differences in the brain relate to individual differences, which is where we are now, you know. And I said, but I'm not a neuropsychologist. I really don't know by training, but it's kind of interesting to see all these patterns, and that's what I presented on. So when I came to Iowa, I was at Hopkins then, and when I came to Iowa State, there was this neuropsychologist. He says, Camilla, I don't believe that. I think that's just bunk. I said, oh, well, you know, I said, well, let's test it then. Even though I study them longitudinally and look at that, I'm always engaged with kids. So, of course, I began programs for gifted kids at Iowa State, and I have begun them here at Vanderbilt because that just is, talent development is important to me. So I said, well, let's do something together. You're the neuropsychologist. I know my kids. And so we started doing some stuff And we did find that there was enhanced right hemisphere functioning. So I did get into it. Hmm. I kind of then became department chair and then went up in administration, and I didn't, you know, we took it a little bit. I also worked with Rich Heyer at UC Irvine, and he and I did some stuff together. So I dabbled in it. I'm not a neuroscientist by training, but I dabbled in it because I thought the connections were there. So I definitely think it's interesting.
So one of the other things that I noticed that I was looking at here, that even this month, the academic journal Neuron from Cell Press, it's a whole special issue, special feature reviews on social neuroscience. Articles like The Role of Neuropeptides in Social Behavior, Tom Insel paper, Sarah Jane Blakemore on the Developing Social Brain, Ralph Adolph's Neuroscience of Social Behavior, Primate Social Cognition paper that came out from Owen Jones and René Marois from here, Neural Correlates of Third-Party Punishment. My point is that, you know, there's this heavy emphasis on use of these new technologies like fMRI to try and figure out what people are thinking and what they're doing. So, I mean, it seems likely that, as I said, we'll be able to get a clearer read on some of these things, although the social behavioral stuff, the pure personal human interaction stuff is crucial as well. So.
It is. I think, we're actually developing a specialization here called educational neuroscience.
Oh, great.
And that's why we hired Bruce, and that's why we hired Lori Cutting, Okay. Because they're neuroscientists who are interested in education. So they train as neuroscientists. It's not people who are, we're doing the hard science. Not the people who try to take neuroscience findings and figure out what might be applications, but actually to study what is the impact of interventions on the organization of the brain. And we have lots, what we had up to this point, we had a lot of people who were doing a lot of work in interventions and behaviors who were interested in how it related to the brain, but really weren't trained as neuroscientists. We have this great imaging center here, John Gore's Imaging Center, and all of these neuroscientists. And by hiring, we kind of felt like, so here we have this great education school that is known from its empirical data-driven work on learning and teaching. You had this great imaging center, and you had all these neuroscientists all over campus, what we needed was the bridge. And we hired the bridge, and now we really are trying to get at this educational neuroscience to try to look at the underpinnings of learning and what these interventions are. How does the brain change as a result of intervention? Can we learn and see better target our interventions by looking how the brain changes? Can we look at how the brain is processing information and know that that's not very optimal, but this intervention moves it in a better way? So that's where we are. We are actually feeling that this is the next frontier, and Peabody wants to be known as leading and being at that frontier and opening up these new areas of knowledge. So that's what we're actually building, and we're giving a presentation to our Board of Trust about what we're doing, and we just think it's just a wonderful confluence of a lot of talent and resources here. So I'm very excited about what the potential can be for education down the road. I think it will, as you talk about, help people be better learners, because if the intervention can make people process information in a way that we know is more effective, then you've become a better learner. But that's also teaching, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Isn't the intervention teaching?
Yeah. So education obviously has been hugely important to this administration as well. One of the things that the Science Network, I've said this to you before, probably till you're bored of hearing it, is that I think it's important to sort of provide gold standard information for people at home at these intersections of science and social policy. So if you're actually watching a health bill go through Congress, or you're watching somebody talking about what they're doing in education, like Arnie Duncan out there on the road, that you have at least some sort of sense of what the professionals are talking about. So we try and support that. So, but one of the things that President Obama said in his inaugural address was that his administration would attempt to restore science to its rightful place. Mm-hmm. What would be the rightful place of science?
Well, I think just like medicine wants to be more evidence-based, I think we want education to be more evidence-based. And the evidence, of course, should be based on scientific evidence. I think the unfortunate thing about education is that our knowledge base is not as deep and as rich. I always speak about this. If you go to 1900 and you went to the educated layperson, you talk to them. At that point in time, medicine and education, in terms of their development of the field and the knowledge base, was about the same place. We didn't know a heck of a lot at the beginning of 1900. If you look what medicine did, they invested billions of dollars into developing the knowledge base for education. For medicine. And we can see what has happened as a result. What we can do today compared to 1900 is amazing. That this educated layperson, probably if you had told them what we could do in 2010, would probably say, I don't believe it. That's unbelievable. Education took a different path. Education certainly invested some money into developing a knowledge base to develop better practices, certainly not to the extent that medicine did. What it focused on was on access. You know, in 1900, not all kids were able to go to school because we didn't have enough schools. So what we focused on was making sure that everybody could go to school. Now, there was differences in the quality of schooling, but we got everybody in school. The challenge in the 21st century for medicine, of course, is access. For education is to build this knowledge base. Now, NIH has a budget of some $30 billion, maybe 35, I don't know where it is, a year to support expanding the knowledge base. In education, it's not even a billion. And it's been at a low level for so long that when people talk about that our knowledge base is thin, you get what you pay for. And so I hope that science will take its right place. I hope we will be driven by scientific findings. I view myself as a scientist. I think science can advance humankind and the human condition, lead to innovations. I think that's our future. I also think that if we invested in research on learning and teaching, kids and adults in 50 years, maybe 75 years, could be learning at levels never before thought possible. And that we have no reason to think that it cannot happen because we haven't invested. So as for education, I think we need to be guided by the best available scientific evidence that is out there. I mean, we do know some things. We do know many things. And then, of course, we have to deal with the best professional judgment after that, but because there are lots of holes and gaps of knowledge. But we do know many things, and I certainly hope that science and the evidence will guide decisions. And I hope that when we work in education, we are really hoping to create the knowledge so that policymakers can make better decisions, create better schools that are not based on, I believe that this will work, but there is evidence that this thing works. So I hope we're getting there. We're investing in the studies. They unfortunately take a long time, but they do take a long time in medicine too. When you do a random controlled trial in medicine, randomized controlled trial in medicine, it takes a number of years. Right. It takes a number of years in education too to do it right. But we're starting to learn. But the biggest issue is that many people make the mistake that they think that if you have a program or an intervention that works in this social context, they can just pick up the program and intervention and move it to another social context and it will work there. But what they don't think about is that there is a whole network of capacity within that social context, sometimes what you can call the DNA of that social organization, that makes it possible the connections between the people, the capacities of the people, the interests, the passions, the community. And that doesn't get transferred when you transfer the intervention. And that's why when you do an intervention, when you take something that looks very promising and you move it to another school, you can't just move it lock, stock, and barrel. You have to actually adjust it to this new environment, to these new capacities. And that's why many people think that there isn't much we have learned, because they want fidelity. You want things to be exactly the same, so you can't change it when you move it to another context. But it's the changing of it that makes it possible for perhaps this intervention to work. So what we need to actually look at is the implementation part. We have things that work in labs and under control settings, or we have things that have worked. How do we make them work in other settings? That's a very critical missing piece. So there's, you know, to me, education, teaching and learning, neuroscience, it's all about learning and development and understanding and enhancing human potential. That's what it's all about, isn't it? Isn't it about enhancing human potential? And we, you know, to enhance human potential, we have to enhance people's capacity to learn, to develop. We need just much more research on this. This is the new frontier. We talk about today's economy. It's a conceptual economy, an ideas-driven economy. It's not the ore that we have in the land. It's the ideas that we can come up with. We got to develop all the children and adults that have maximum capacity, and we need to invest in the research and attract the best talent into our field to make that possible.
So what advice would you give to a young scientist at this point?
To a what? I'm
sorry. A young scientist just coming into the field.
Well, first of all, you need to do rigorous research. And I would say to them, there are so many low-hanging fruits to be picked. There's so much exciting stuff, the frontier. So many others, you know, biology and physics, there are still many wonderful questions waiting out there. But here, it's such a new landscape. There's so much to be done, so much to experiment with. So, and what I would say is, look at all the societal benefits of the work that you can do. You can have immediate impact. That's what drove me here, working in the reality of education in the real world, real kids, real people, and helping them become better than they thought they could be. That's rewarding.
Yeah. So there's a couple of questions. I was going to ask you one thing, which is, what are you optimistic about? But it sounds as though you're very optimistic about the way this field is possibly going to go.
I'm very optimistic. I think the 21st century is ours if we grab it. We have to grab it. And we have to convince the policymakers and so on that this is something that America can again lead in. Lead the world. It's another scientific field. We really are leading it already, in a way. But we can really launch ahead. And I would say, you got to have opportunities. You know, you got to create conditions for success. If people, you know, smart people look and they say there's $35 billion going into work in biology and medicine, and there is less than a billion, where are the opportunities? 35 to 1. So they got to create the opportunities. They got to create the grants and get people excited about it. But here we can make the biggest difference if we can actually build human potential, and I think we can. And we're just beginning to learn what we can do.
Camilla Benbow, thanks very much.
You're welcome.